They watched the aircraft grow in size until its wings seemed to fill half the sky, and then its profile altered as the great wing flaps dropped and the ramp below its belly drooped open. Big Dolly slowed her flight so dramatically that she seemed to hang suspended on an invisible thread from the high African sun. Slowly she came round, banking steeply as Yanni lined her up on the smoke flares, dropping lower and still lower, headed directly at where they stood. With a savage roar that made all three of them duck, she passed so low over their heads that it seemed she would wipe them off the crest. Nicholas had a glimpse of Yanni peering down at him from the cockpit, a fat smile on his face, and one hand raised in a laconic wave, and then he was past. Nicholas straightened up and watched Big Dolly sweep majestically down the centre of the valley. The first pallet dropped out of her and plunged earthwards until, at the last moment, its parachutes burst open like a bride's bouquet. The fall of the heavier container was arrested abruptly. It dangled and swung, and seconds later struck the floor of the valley in a cloud of yellow dust and with a crash that they could hear up on the ridge. Then two more loads dropped from her, and they too hung for a moment on their chutes before they slammed in. Big Dolly's engines howled under full throttle, and her nose lifted as she bored for height, while she passed over the crimson smoke clouds and then climbed out of the deadly trap of the valley. She came round in another wide turn and lined up for the second run. Once again the pallets dropped out of her as she roared over the quartz markers and then climbed out over the end wall of the valley, skimming the rocky spikes that would have clawed her down. 6 times Yanni repeated the dangerous manoeuvre, and each time he dropped 3 of the heavy rectangular loads. They lay strewn down the length of the valley, shrouded by the tumbled white silk of their own parachutes. As Yanni climbed away from the last pass, his voice echoed in Nicholas's earphones. "Don't go away, Pharaoh. I'll be back." Then Big Dolly lifted her belly ramp like an old lady hoisting her knickers and headed away westwards. Nicholas and Mech ran down into the valley where the monks were already jabbering and laughing around the pallets. Quickly the two of them took control, sorting the men into gangs and directing them as they broke down the loads and carried them away. Nicholas and Sapper had planned that the pallets should be dropped in the order that their contents would be needed. The first pallet contained canned and dried food. All their personal effects and camping equipment, along with those other little creature comforts that Nicholas had allowed, including mosquito nets and a case of malt whiskey. He was relieved to see that there was no leakage from the precious case. Not one of the bottles had been broken in the drop. Sapper took charge of the building material and heavy equipment. With Tessé relaying his orders, it was dragged and manhandled away to the ancient quarry where it would be packed and stored until needed on site. Darkness fell with more than half the pallets still not unpacked, lying where they had fallen. Mech placed an armed guard over them, and they all traipsed warily back up the valley to the camp. That night, with a dram of whiskey and a decent meal warming his belly, a mosquito net over his head and a thick foam mattress under him, Nicholas drifted off to sleep with a smile on his face. They were off to a good start. The chanting of the monks at their matins woke him. "Oh, we won't need an alarm clock here," he groaned, and staggered down to the river to wash and shave. As the sun gilded the battlements of the escarpment, he and Mech were already at their post on the heights, searching the western sky. The plan had been for Yanni to spend the night at Rosaris, while Mech's men assisted him with the loading of the cargo they had stored there on their first flight out from Malta. This was one of the vulnerable stages of the operation. Although Mech had assured them that there was little military presence in the area at the moment, it needed only a stray Sudanese government patrol to stumble on Big Dolly while she was on the ground to plunge them all into disaster. So it was with a leap of heart that they heard the familiar drone of the turboprops reverberating off the cliffs. Big Dolly lined up again for her first pass down the valley, and as she flew over the quartz crosses, the huge yellow front-end loader tumbled out of her hold. Instinctively, Nicholas held his breath as he watched it come hurtling down and then jerk up short on the parachute shrouds. It swayed wildly all over the sky, yo-yoing on the nylon ropes, and the monks howled with amazement and excitement as they watched it drop in. It struck in a cloud of dust. Sapper was standing next to Nicholas, groaning and covering his eyes, so that he did not have to watch the cloud of dust rising into the air. "Shit," he said in a hollow voice. "Is that a command or merely a request?" Nicholas asked. But he wasn't really amused. As the last pallet dropped and the aircraft climbed away under full power, Nicholas called Yanni on the radio. "Many thanks, Big Dolly. Safe flight home." "Inshallah, if God wills," Yanni called back. "I'll call you when I need a lift back." "I'll be waiting," Big Dolly trundled away. "Break a leg." "Well now," Nicholas slapped Sapper's back, "let's go down and see if you still have a front ender." The battered yellow machine lay on its side with oil pouring out of her, like blood from a heart-shot dinosaur. "You can push off. Just leave me and a dozen of these black guys to help me," Sapper told them sorrowfully, as if he was standing at the graveside of his beloved. Sapper did not return to camp for dinner, so Tessé sent a bowl of wat and some injera bread down to him to eat while he worked. Nicholas considered going down to offer his help with repairing the damaged tractor, but thought better of it. From bitter experience, he knew that at certain times Sapper wanted to be left alone, and that this was one of those times. In the small, dark hours of the morning, the camp was lit up by the blaze of headlights, and the hills reverberated to the roar of diesel engine. With even his bald head covered with grease and dust, hollow-eyed but triumphant, Sapper drove the yellow tractor into the camp and shouted at them from the high driver's seat. "Okay, knaves and nymphs, drop your cocks and grab your socks. Let's go build a dam." It took them another 2 full days to gather in all the pallets that lay strewn down the valley and to carry the stores into the ancient quarry. There they stacked them carefully in accordance with the manifest that Nicholas and Sapper had drawn up in England. It was essential that they knew where every item was stored, and that they had immediate access to it when needed. In the meantime, Sapper was at work on the dam site, laying out his foundations, driving numbered wooden pegs into the banks of the river, and taking his final measurements with the long steel surveyor's tape. During this preliminary work, Nicholas was watching the performance of the monks and getting to know them individually. He was able to pick out the natural leaders and the most intelligent and willing men amongst them. He was also able to identify those who spoke Arabic or a little English. The most promising of these was a monk named Hansith Sheriff, whom Nicholas made his personal assistant and interpreter. Once they were settled into the camp and had worked out a relationship with the monks, McNamur took Nicholas aside out of earshot of the two women. "From now on, my work will be the security of the site. We will have to be ready to prevent another raid like the one on your camp and the slaughter at St. Frumentius. Nogo and his thugs are still out there. It won't take long for him to hear that you are back in the gorge. When he comes, I will be waiting for him." "You're better with an AK-47 than a pickaxe," Nicholas agreed. "Just leave Tessé here with me. I need her." "So do I," Mech smiled and shook his head ruefully. "I am only just learning how much. Look after her for me. I will be back every night to check on her." Mech took his men into the bush and deployed them in defensive positions along the trail and around the camp. When Nicholas looked up from his own work, he could often make out the figure of one of Mech's sentries on the high ground above the camp. It was reassuring to know that they were there. However, as he had promised, Mech was back in camp most evenings, and often in the night Nicholas heard, coming from the shelter he shared with Tessé, his deep rumbling laughter blending with her sweet silvery tones. Then Nicholas lay awake and thought about Rayan in the hut, so close, but yet so far away from where he lay. On the fifth day, the second draft of 300 labourers that Maimatema had conscripted for them arrived, and Nicholas was astonished. Things seldom worked that way in Africa. Nothing ever happened ahead of the promised time. He wondered what exactly Mac had told the abbot, but then decided that he didn't really want to know. For now, the main construction work could begin. These men were not monks, for St. Frumentius had already given its all to the sacred labour, but villagers who lived up on the highlands of the escarpment. My Matema had coerced them with promises of religious indulgences and threats of hell fire. Nicholas and Sapper divided this workforce into gangs of 30 men each, and set one of the picked monks as foreman over each gang. They were careful to grade the men by their physical appearance, so that the big strapping specimens were all grouped together as the project stormtroopers, while the smaller, more wiry men could be reserved for the tasks in which brute strength was not a necessity. Nicholas dreamed up a name for each gang. The buffaloes, the lions, the axes, and so on. It taxed his powers of invention, but he wanted to inspire in them a sense of pride, and to his own particular advantage, to encourage the gangs to compete with one another. He paraded them in the quarry, each group headed by its newly appointed ecclesiastical foreman, using one of the ancient stone blocks as a platform, and with Tese interpreting for him, he harangued them heartily, and then told them that they would be paid in silver Maria Theresa dollars. He set their wages at 3 times the going rate. Up to this stage, the men had listened to him with a sullen air of resignation, but now a remarkable transformation came over them. None of them had expected to be paid for the work, and most of them were wondering how soon they could desert and go home. Now Nicholas was promising them not only money, but silver dollars. In Ethiopia for the past 200 years, the Maria Theresa dollar had been regarded as the only true coinage. For this reason, they were still minted with the original date of 1780 and the portrait of the old empress, with her double chin and her décolletage exposing half her great bust. One of these coins was more prized than a sackful of the worthless paper burr issued by the regime in Addis. To pay his labour bills, Nicholas had included a chest of these silver dollars in the first pallet load that Yanni had dropped. Celestial grins bloomed as they listened, and white teeth sparkled in their ebony faces. Someone began to sing, and they all stamped and danced and cheered Nicholas as they trooped off to queue for their tools. With mattocks and shovels at the slope, they filed off up the valley to the dam site, still singing and prancing. "Saint Nicholas," Tessé laughed, "Father Christmas, they will never forget you now." "They may even enshrine you and build a monastery over you," Royan suggested sweetly. "What they don't know is that they are going to earn every single dollar the hard way." From then onwards, the work began as soon as it was light enough to see and stopped only when it was too dark to continue. The men came back to their temporary compound each night by the light of grass torches, too weary to sing. However, Nicholas had contracted with the headmen from the highland villages to supply a slaughter beast every day. Each morning the women came down the trail, driving the animal before them, and with huge pots of tej balanced on their heads. Over the days that followed, there were no deserters from Nicholas's little army of workers. Mounted on the high seat of the front ender, Sapper lifted the first filled mesh gabion in the hydraulic arms. The mesh-bound parcel of boulders weighed several tons, and all work on the site came to a halt as the men crowded the banks of the Dandira River to watch. A hum of astonishment went up as Sapper eased the yellow tractor down the steep bank, and with the gabion held high, drove the vehicle into the water. The current, affronted by this invasion, swirled angrily around the high rear wheels, but Sapper pushed in deeper. The crowds lining the bank began to chant and clap encouragement as the water reached as high as the belly of the machine, and clouds of steam hissed from the hot steel of the sump. Sapper locked the brakes, and then lowered the heavy gabion into the flood before reversing back up the bank.